Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, and we are going to lead off with a thanksgiving to God for the release of Andrew Brunson. He has been released to U.S. diplomatic personnel. And we are going to get to talk in just a few minutes with Icon Erdemir. Icon has been here on Connecting Faith throughout the course of this saga of Andrew Brunson's detainment and imprisonment and the horrendous experience that our Christian brother Andrew has had over the last 2 years in Turkey. And so I'm going to wait to talk more about Andrew's release and the circumstances surrounding it when Icon can join us in just a few minutes. So let me spend the first few minutes here today talking about Hurricane Michael, particularly the aftermath. And when we use the word aftermath, because, you know, I like to create some mental hooks that we can then sort of hang our conversational talking points on. And you're going to hear the word aftermath a lot. In the aftermath of the storm, you know, what's happening in the aftermath of the storm? How are people going to cope in the aftermath of the storm? And so I want you to think about that word aftermath. Aftermath, I'm generally happy because I don't like math. So it's one way to think about it. But what I want to talk about is counting the cost. I want to actually do the math. And you're going to see the math done related to Hurricane Andrew in several different ways. So people use different calculus in terms of approaching the aftermath of a storm. You're certainly going to see those who want to lay some blame. You are cast some blame. You're going to see those who are going to suggest that authorities did not do enough to get people to leave, and therefore there is a death toll related to this storm. You're going to see math related to loss of physical life, and you're going to see a lot of math, a lot of aftermath related to counting the cost of both residential and commercial buildings and businesses and people's ability to move forward. I mean, there are now no schools. There are now no churches. There are now no houses. There are now there is now no infrastructure. There are no trees. There are no poles upon which electricity could be run. There certainly are no grocery stores. There are no banks. I mean, just go down the list. It's just not there. I mean, surely by now you you've seen the footage. You know the devastation that we're talking about, particularly at that just most horrendous scene in Mexico Beach. So Mexico Beach, largely populated by people who are retired. So my guess is if you're retired, you don't spend the next portion of your life figuring out how to rebuild in a place that is going to be substantially different than it was when you chose to spend some of your retirement years, on the beautiful Gulf Coast next to the white sandy beaches. The white sandy beach is still there, but there's no trees and there's no, on and on. There's no nothing. So it'd be a rebuilding literally from the sand up, which, of course, leads us to a conversation about should we be building our lives on sand at all? Yes, I recognize that the conversation here about having a house that is on the water is a conversation about enjoying the beauty of God's great creation. But it does give us as Christians an opportunity to talk about where we build our houses, and it gives us an opportunity to share the parable that Jesus articulates, recorded. Well, I'll just pull it here from Matthew chapter 7. Jesus says this: everyone who hears my words and does them, so this is not just hearers of the word, but doers also. That's actually what this passage is about. Not just being people who know what the Bible says, but actually being people who live what the Bible says. So Jesus, this is Jesus speaking. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded upon a rock. Now, everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them, well, that person is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell. And great was its fall. So this is not, I'm not offering this parable as any condemnation to those who build houses on the coast or on the beach. I, too, love the view, love to walk on the sand, love to enjoy the sunset. But it does give us as Christians an opportunity to reframe the conversation of the day. It gives us an opportunity to talk about where we actually do build our lives and what our lives are built upon. And it gives us an opportunity to juxtapose the way some people are counting the cost. Some people are doing the calculus of the aftermath, which is going to be in terms of dollars, which, by the way, let's see, Fortune just posted this, that they believe that the damage cost from Hurricane Michael are going to top $4.5 billion with a B. So that would be one way of measuring the cost of this storm. And then if you scroll around and you're looking for the way others are counting the cost, you will see a rising death toll related to Hurricane Michael. You will note that at least six people died as a direct result of the storm. And then you're also going to hear a lot of conversation. There's still ongoing conversation related to the death toll related from Hurricane Maria last year. Puerto Rico, it was dramatic that the official death toll was held to 64 when something more like 3,000 people actually died, as in what would be described as, you know, for reasons related to the storm. They'd be alive had it not been for the passing of this storm through their island, through their community, and through their life. And so when we talk about counting the cost of this storm, and we talk about counting the cost of discipleship, and we talk about where we're going to build our lives and what we're going to do, obviously there are passages of Scripture to which we can turn and we can lift up in our conversations with others. And so I would encourage you to do just that. I also want you to take note of the fact, and if you are in a position to do so, help with what I describe as the fools who rush in. You'll notice that following any one of these disasters, there are actually those who are like, they're prepared to rush in. And when we hear FEMA, when we hear Governor Rick Scott, when we hear people related to the government, and they talk about having all of these resources lined up ready to go, they talk about staging, and they had all kinds of resources staged in a number of locations ready to rush in. Like there were like power companies from like 16 states already staged to head into the areas affected in order that power could be restored as soon as possible. Now we've seen the devastation. We know that the restoration of power is not actually probably a first order business in some of these communities. But for folks living without power for a very long period of time, you know, the tick tock of that starts to eat away at you. And so, you know, we're certainly grateful for all of the resources that the government makes available, and they rush in to help. But they're not the only ones rushing in. Like you say, well, they've got an obligation to rush in. Like that's part of what the government does for us, and we appreciate it. There's also a bunch of what we would describe as fools who rush in, right? Now, this is sort of in the foolishness of love spirit here. So there were also, prior to the storm, there were a bunch of Baptists in Florida and Georgia already setting up staging areas, preparing to rush in. And it was also happening through Samaritan's Purse. It was happening through the American Red Cross. The Southern Baptists do this fools rush in thing through something they call the North American Mission Board. The North American Mission Board provides national coordination and assistance to like multi-state responses. So there's all kinds of groups of Baptists that, you know, work together, and actually they network with others as well. So the reason that I point this out is because Christians were literally on the ground helping people get back in and helping people sort through and helping people imagine a very different future than the one they had prior to the arrival of Hurricane Michael. Christians were on the ground putting flesh on the gospel, handing out bottles of water. And, you know, and there's just so much that needs to be done in the aftermath of a storm. And I just love it that like fools. Christians are all set up to rush in. So if you are in a position to help those who are on the ground helping, let me encourage you to do so. Obviously, you can help through the American Red Cross. I'd also encourage you to consider helping through Samaritan's Purse and through the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention. Those seem to be three of the organizations that they're always on the ground responding and doing so in ways that, you know, that I would say we can trust and we can feel good about. Obviously, if you have relationships with congregations in the affected communities, you could give your direct help in that way as well. All right, friends, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I am going to be talking with Icon Erdemir. Icon is the senior fellow for the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's a former member of the Turkish Parliament. And I'm going to let him share the good news with you about Andrew Brunson. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back.
Freedom's name is mighty sweet. And one day soon we're gonna meet. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined now by our oftentimes guest whom we hear from, Icon Erdemir. He is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And we have Icon on every time we want to talk about Andrew Brunson. And man, do we want to talk about that today. So, Icon, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. And so I'm happy to say that we have some good news to discuss today.
I know. I'm thrilled. So I'm going to let you share with our listeners the good news.
It's of course a mixed decision because the Turkish court today convicted Pastor Andrew Brunson to 3 years, 1 month and 15 days of prison. But this was a very surgically decided prison term because the time he served in prison meets the minimum requirement. So as of today, Pastor Brunson will be able to walk free. It's a mixed decision for us because at the same time he's now smeared as a convicted felon, and that's just part of the travesty of justice that the Turkish government has put us all through here.
So we're going to celebrate that this person for whose release we've been praying now for since October of 2016. For those folks who are listening who, you know, might not have been paying as close attention to Andrew Brunson's case as you have been paying, remind them about the charges against him and then also remind them, Icon, of sort of the context of those charges.
Sure. Pastor Andrew Brunson has been living in and serving peacefully in Turkey for over 20 years. 2 years ago, in October, he was detained and then arrested on ludicrous charges of military espionage, plotting the coup, terrorism, and not just with one organization, but two different armed organizations who are at odds with one another. And after 17 months in prison without an indictment, finally, the prosecutors produced a 62-page farcical indictment, which had the most outrageous accusations based on not a single shred of concrete evidence, but a number of secret witness testimonies. And today in court, we have seen that four of those secret witnesses have retracted their statements, which again proves what a show trial this has been, what a travesty of justice this has been. And then to save the Turkish government from embarrassment, the judge issued a short prison term, which makes Andrew now a convicted felon in Turkey, who can no longer serve in Turkey. But at the same time, it allows him to walk free, trying to preempt a further escalation of crisis between Washington and Ankara, Turkey.
So, friends, again, that voice you're hearing is Icon Erdemir. He is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You can follow him on Twitter at Icon_Erdemir. You can also visit the Foundation for Defense of Democracies at defenddemocracy.org. Icon, we're hearing a lot about Turkey in the news. So give us a sense of what else is going on that you are following in terms of what's happening in Turkey.
Now, first, let's remind our audience that Andrew Brunson is just one of the dozens of Western nationals who have been snatched by Turkish authorities in the aftermath of an abortive coup in July 2016. And he, alongside a number of other Western nationals, was used as a bargaining chip by Turkey's strongman Recep Tayyip Erdogan as he tried to extract concessions from the U.S. As well as from a number of other NATO ally countries. And the more Turkey's strongman Erdogan needs now favors from the West, especially given the economic downturn in Turkey, he has started releasing some of these hostages. And so Andrew is not just a prisoner of conscience, but at the same time, he's caught in this kind of major geopolitical struggles. He has been a pawn who has been smeared, who has been framed just to be used as a bargaining chip. And now that we see a Turkish-Saudi crisis with the alleged assassination of journalist Khashoggi, now that we see U.S. and Turkey negotiating about a potential U.S. Treasury fine for a Turkish state bank's sanctions busting, now that we see U.S.-Turkey negotiating what to do with Syrian Kurds, Andrew Brunson, Pastor Brunson, was at the center of all these negotiations and bargaining. It's really sad that a person's life, career, family, colleagues, could be hit, could be really tortured by a strong man who has no regard for either religious freedom or human rights or human dignity. And it will take, I argue, at least a generation or two of Turkish citizens to undo.
So, friends, again, that voice you're hearing is Icon Erdemir. He is the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's also a former member of the Turkish parliament, and so he understands these issues and concerns, well, at a very personal level, and has concerns about a Turkey that some of us might not exactly share. So, Icon, I'm curious, one more question before we let you go. And again, thank you for sharing with us on this particularly joyous occasion. We really didn't know when we scheduled to have this conversation whether or not we would be talking about good news or whether or not we would be talking about another delay in terms of Andrew Brunson's I'm gonna use the word justice, even though I recognize that what has been accomplished is not really justice, but it's at least liberty. And so we're gonna be thankful for the freedom won in this particular case. Tell us what the status is of other Americans who continue to be held in Turkey under what we would regard as equally spurious charges.
Yes, I have co-authored a piece with my colleague Merve Tahiroğlu on other Americans in Turkey. There is at least one NASA scientist, there is a physics professor, and more importantly, there are three Turkish staff members of the U.S. missions in Turkey in prison, also held as bargaining chips. And it's important that as we celebrate Pastor Brunson's liberty today, we also keep in mind other prisoners of the Turkish strongman who are held on equally ludicrous charges. And also, let's keep in mind that there are a number of European Union citizens from a number of countries, and hence our call this July with Ambassador Eric Edelman in our report on Erdogan's hostage diplomacy, that we need a transatlantic response. We need to have the European Union and the United States working together to make sure not a single Western hostage remains in Erdogan's dungeons.
Mm. Icon, thank you for your ongoing work on this particular front, and thank you for joining us today and bringing us up to date here on Connecting Faith.
Carmen, it was a pleasure sharing the good news with you on your program today.
It's always good to talk with you. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, friends. So we can now report that Andrew Brunson has been actually released. He has been transferred into the custody of U.S. diplomats. We can now confirm that he is free. And according to the United States government, he will be en route to the United States later today. If you go online, you can actually see pictures of him. I have seen a picture of him standing with Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Tony Perkins also serves on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And so Tony was in the courtroom today with Andrew. He also had the opportunity to spend time with Andrew yesterday, and Tony Perkins has posted that he had the opportunity to not only pray with Andrew and his wife, Noreen, but to share with them, to deliver to them, hand-deliver letters, personal letters from President Trump and Vice President Pence, assuring them of the administration's commitment to them and the underlying principles of religious freedom. Tony Perkins says, I also took the opportunity to share with them the full list of names of 16,000 Christians in the United States who just over the last few days has pledged to stand in prayer with Andrew and Noreen. And those prayers, Tony Perkins acknowledges, have now been answered. So we want to, you know, we want to celebrate Andrew's liberty. We want to celebrate the reality of answered prayer. We want to celebrate that this certainly is the day for which he and his family have been praying. But there are other families whose loved ones are still held unjustly in places all around the world. And so we want to be sure that we continue in an attitude of prayer and pleading, that we don't find ourselves satisfied with the release of one person unjustly accused and held, but that we would literally be people who would seek justice throughout our own culture and the cultures of the world when people's religious liberty is frankly persecuted, when they are kept from being allowed to live in the freedom of their religious conscience. So let's continue to pursue God with those prayers. We certainly know that they align with his will. And so let's be praying together for Christians around the world and other persecuted religious minorities. Hey, friends, when I come back, I'm going to be having a very special conversation with Sarah Williams. Sarah is going to tell us a very, very personal and intimate story about her daughter, Sarian, and the albeit very, very short life of Sarian, how much it has changed not only Sarah's life, but the life of so many others. So you're listening to Connecting Faith. When I come back, I'll be in a conversation with Sarah Williams about Perfectly Human. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined by Sarah Williams. Sarah's actually joining us today from the Cotswolds in England. It's a beautiful part of the world. And she's joining us today to talk about what I will describe as her spiritual autobiography. It's entitled Perfectly Human. Sarah, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
So I'm not going to spoil the story. I am going to allow you to tell it. Let's just begin by, why don't you introduce us to Carrion?
I will. Carrion was our third daughter, and she was much longed for and looked forward to. And then at the 20-week scan, we discovered that she had a lethal skeletal dysplasia that would result in her death either at birth or shortly after birth, which, as you can imagine, was a huge shock totally unexpected and very sad. At the time, we were recommended that the best course of action, given the severity of her condition, was to terminate the pregnancy. And my husband, Paul, and I decided that we didn't want to do that, that we wanted to carry her through to the very end of her life, even if that life didn't actually involve a day.
I would, I know that it's radio, so people can't actually see the photograph on the cover of the book. But could you tell us about the photograph that's on the cover of the book and tell us what we're looking at?
They've done a really beautiful job with the book. It is the hands of a woman and the hands of a man holding the tiny feet of a little baby. And they're holding the baby with incredible tenderness and with incredible gentleness. And their hands form a kind of arc, which actually looks like a prenatal scan. It's an incredible image that carries the very heart message of the book.
It does. It's just beautiful. And friends, the book we're talking about is Perfectly Human, 9 Months with Carrion. How did Carrion change your life, Sarah?
She showed me how deeply God loves the weak and the vulnerable. It was a privilege to carry her to her death. She died just before she was born. And those 16 weeks that I carried her radically transformed my understanding of what it means to be human. I encountered God's love during those weeks in a very fresh and vivid way. And it turned my value system upside down. I was teaching at the University of Oxford at the time. I was with people who were full of confidence and full of strength. And it was like having my whole world revolutionized and turned upside down.
Let's pursue that conversation, because you talk about how Carrion not only affected your family and your family life, but also your academic and professional life. Tell us a little bit more about that part of the story.
Yeah, it was an incredible juxtaposition of carrying Carrion whilst also trying to continue my work. And on the one hand, encountering my own vulnerability and the vulnerability of the child I was carrying, and yet at the same time, encountering some fairly fierce arguments from some of my colleagues who found it quite difficult to understand why somebody would want to carry a severely abnormal child to birth. And some people even made the argument that it actually wasn't moral to bring into existence a person who you knew would suffer. And those arguments were really difficult for me to navigate, really difficult for me to think through. And particularly some of my female colleagues found it a high risk strategy on my part that I was willing to contemplate the possibility of what it might do to my career.
I want to read a couple of sentences here from Perfectly Human, 9 Months with Carrion, to give folks a sense of this part of the story. When a doctor asks if Sarah, with whom I'm speaking now, has decided against an abortion on strong religious grounds, Sarah responds, "Carrion is not a strong religious principle or a rule that compels me to make hard and fast ethical decisions. She's a beautiful person who is teaching me to love the vulnerable, treasure the unlovely, and face fear with dignity and hope." Sarah, I'm wondering what kinds of conversations you have had with women and couples in the position that you and Paul were in. I'm wondering if there have been opportunities to have conversations with other people in this decision-making process, because I think that for people who are listening right now, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road. The offer of an abortion is so readily available and often encouraged by medical professionals and others. Talk with us about that decision-making process.
It is an exceptionally difficult situation to be placed in, of having to make a decision. Whether you want to make that decision or not, it becomes imperative. And I think what we felt more than anything else was the pressure and the speed with which we were expected to make that decision. And I think the one thing I would say to folk if they ever found themselves in this position is to take time to be still. The last thing you feel like doing when you're in a crisis is being still. And yet being still gives the space, it gives the opportunity to set the decision in a wider context. And my experience over the years has been, it is much harder to grieve a termination than it is to grieve the loss of a child when you know that you did everything you possibly could to love and cherish them while they were there. And the dignity of being able to have a funeral with friends and family, it is a precious gift. And in the long term, that opportunity gives a great deal of comfort to families, whether they are families of faith or not. It is very hard to grieve a termination. But women who find themselves in that position, couples who find themselves in that position, it is incredibly important to move towards them with extreme compassion, because it is unbelievably difficult to know what to do and how to go about making that decision.
Friends, my conversation partner is Sarah Williams. We're talking about her spiritual autobiography, Perfectly Human, 9 months with Carrion. It also occurred to me, Sarah, that this could have just been described as Carrion's biography. It really is her story, and how her life affected your life and obviously your husband's life and the life of your kids. Talk with us a little bit about that. Talk with us about how this experience with this person, Carrion, changed your marriage and your family.
I love the way you put that. You put it so well. Our culture doesn't recognize the personhood of the unborn. The language that we use to describe the unborn tends to objectify the fetus rather than to understand the unborn as real people with whom you have a relationship, even when they're in the womb. And for us as a family, Carrion was a precious gift. She drew us together in as a family in a very remarkable way. And for Paul and I, being able to support one another through that journey, those 16 weeks, particularly after we knew the diagnosis, we were given an amazing gift by God of together loving somebody that we needed to care for because they were vulnerable and weak and they needed our love. And we were able to gather together as a family around Carrion, and she did transform our family. And in the long term, as I look back now in the longer framework and look at those events, she had a significant ongoing impact on our family, on both the girls and also on Paul and my relationship. I have to say that after she died, it was hard. A lot of couples split up after they lose a child. It is incredibly difficult to grieve well together. I grieved really differently from Paul, and at times we didn't have the resources that we needed to support one another. We were just so grateful that we were in a community with other people who understood our differences and were able to help us to navigate that well, because I can understand how it can really rip couples apart. And I think the fact that we were aware of that as a danger was also a gift. In the longer term, it has drawn us together in God in ways that we didn't know before.
Sarah, thank you. I feel like the book is a gift, and I feel like it gives us the opportunity to talk about very challenging issues in our culture, very challenging conversations that more and more people need to be having, not just with their medical professionals, but they need to be having these conversations at a very deep personal level with their families and with their friends at church, with our family of faith. And we need to be influencing the larger political and even academic conversations that are going on in the culture at large on the question of identity and personhood. And so thank you for giving voice to Carrion's life and her life experience. And thank you for sharing it with us in Perfectly Human, 9 months with Carrion.
Thank you.
Friends, I have to take one more quick break. If you've been listening to this conversation and you've been thinking to yourself, that's a book I would really love to have a copy of. I think I have one that is available to give away. So if this is really a heart issue for you, we would love for you to be the person who has this book. You can text me at 877-933-2484. You can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Let me just ask Rachel, is the listener who wants to talk about Gosnell still available? And if so, let's put them on. Okay, otherwise I'll just talk about it by myself because it was what I have listed here to talk about next. So hopefully if you texted in or you called in that you were interested in talking about the Gosnell movie, man, you're just one step ahead of me, which I love. I love our listeners. I love the interaction with you. I love your engagement with the subject matter. And you're right. We need to be talking about the Gosnell movie. It releases in theaters tonight. If you're saying to yourself, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. Well, there's a reason for that. I think that the mainstream media has absolutely no interest in letting folks know that this film has been made. Certainly during the Gosnell trial, the mainstream media had no interest in covering the details. And why is that? Well, because it doesn't support a narrative that says abortion is good. So for those of you who remain or who are unfamiliar with what happened, the trial of Kermit Gosnell, a Philadelphia abortionist who was convicted in May of 2013 of first-degree murder in the deaths of newborns and involuntary manslaughter in the death of one of his patients. That story was almost completely ignored in the national news, which is staggering when you think about the things that the news media does cover. And the Gosnell hearings were gruesome. The details that came out were gruesome. And I will acknowledge that. This is clearly not a family movie in terms of its content. There will be, I'm sure, scenes depicting the 47 dead babies that were found in the basement. The severed parts of little people. And the rusty, unsterilized medical instruments, and on and on and on. I think that it is going to be don't have dinner before you go, but absolutely go. And if you're a person who's saying to yourself, you know what, there's just no way I could watch that. There's no way I could see that. You know what? As an act of like civil outrage that that the story did not get more coverage than it got, and that the movie has not gotten more coverage than it's gotten. Buy a ticket anyway. You know, buy a ticket to the movie and don't go if you don't think you can stomach it, which I completely 100% understand. If you think you can stomach it, this is one of those movies that you don't go to see because it's going to be fun. This is one of those movies that you go to see, like Schindler's List. Remember that movie? That's not a movie you went to see because it was fun. That's a movie you went to see because everybody needs to know and understand what happened in the Holocaust. Everybody needs to know and understand what is happening in America to little babies and, frankly, to pregnant women. Because there are more victims in terms of abortion than just the babies. For every baby who's a victim, there's a mom who's a victim as well. So Again, the Gosnell movie releases in theaters tonight. It's just called Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. And you would think that that would be leading, you know, I don't know, leading the information wave out there, and yet it's not. So hopefully the listener who wanted me to lift that up is satisfied with the way that I did that. If not, you can always text me your comments at 877-933-2484. And I love to hear from you via email as well. Obviously, you can get more said in an email, and you can do that at carmen@myfaithradio.com. For those of you who have already been asking, hey, where is Sarah Williams' social media? Where's the social media related to Perfectly Human, which is the book we just discussed? There isn't any. Sarah is a really shy, introverted person. She is not on social media. So Perfectly Human is just a book you're just going to have to experience yourself. You're not going to get the tidbits that sometimes are tossed out there on social media. This is one that you'll just have to consume in toto. Okay, and again, it's entitled Perfectly Human, 9 Months with Carrion. And Carrion is spelled C-E-R-I-A-N. I suppose I should tell you what that means, because it's in my notes here. Carrion is, where is it? It's a Welsh name. I'm looking for the way it's described. It's Welsh for loved one, which I just think is so sweet and dear. Okay, we're certainly at the point where I'm supposed to be making the connecting point. So maybe the Gosnell movie could be part of like a Friday connecting point. But I have another one to cast out upon the water as well today, and that's this. Sometimes there's a headline that catches my attention, and I find myself wanting to talk about it, and I'm like, I just really don't know where that's going to fit. And so it always seems to fit on Friday. So here you go. Here's Friday's attempt at a connecting point. The United Kingdom has appointed a minister of suicide prevention. You may remember that earlier this year, the United Kingdom appointed a minister for loneliness. So loneliness is epidemic. Loneliness is not only epidemic in the UK, it's epidemic here in the United States. And that seems maybe like an odd thing. But suicide is also fairly epidemic. And we have talked on a number of occasions about the subject of suicide here in the United States. And I want to just give a little shout out here to a listener named Dort. Dort, thank you for your email. Thank you for letting us know that you're listening. Dort writes that last month their church family experienced a suicide of a young man. And then the two programs that we had here on Connecting Faith, both on September 10th and on September the 14th, were helpful. And Dort was looking to access those in order that they might be shared with others. And so let me just answer that question here on the air. Hopefully, Dort, we also answered it directly in an email. Friends, all you have to do is go to myfaithradio.com and click on the podcast, and you can get the podcast for this program. You can get the podcast for other programs as well. You can always go to the Connecting Faith page on My Faith Radio. So on the myfaithradio.com website, you just click on programs, and then you'd click on Connecting Faith. And if you just scroll down, you'll see the most recent programs, but then you can also actually see all the programs if you want. There's a handy dandy search box. It's actually a little, it looks like a little magnifying glass. If you click on the magnifying glass and you type in the word suicide, let me just try that. I've got the website up. If you type in the word suicide into that little box and you hit search, you're actually going to get 73 different programs that have aired on My Faith Radio in relationship to this subject. And so if you specifically want one of the ones that you heard on Connecting Faith, as you scroll down that list, you'll come across the programs where we have dealt with that subject matter area. I'll remind you that you can always check out the ministry of June Hunt. We had her on to talk about suicide prevention and suicide intervention, and she's one of my favorites out there. If you've got teenagers who are engaged in suicide ideation, there's a thing called the Hope Line. in it. And I just really encourage you to engage with some of the ministries that are out there that are providing genuine, authentic engagement. Don't wait for the government, like the UK has. Don't wait for the government to appoint a minister of suicide prevention. Go out there and be a minister of suicide prevention today. Like, you and I are ministers. Like, that's the lingo of the Bible. And we're supposed to be ministers of reconciliation, which means that we shouldn't need a government-level minister of loneliness, because Christians should actually be out there engaging in relationships with other people. A ministry of reconciliation would actually require human interaction, engagement. And that's, frankly, the solution to loneliness, is actually spending time with each other, with other people. And so don't wait for the government to appoint a minister of for loneliness, nor a minister for suicide prevention. Get out there and be a minister for loneliness, actually a minister against loneliness, and get out there and be a minister for suicide prevention. You and I can actually do that. Tragically, we actually have this bridge near where we live that whenever the county just to the south of us gets word that somebody is missing, particularly a young person, they actually, that's the first place they go and look. They look at the base of the bridge. And so what could we do to intervene on that bridge? Like, you know, let's just go hang out there at all hours of the day and night. You got nothing else to do. You're feeling lonely. Go out there and be a minister against the loneliness of a person who is actually thinking that their life is not even worth living anymore. It's going to make your life seem a whole lot more important and valuable if you're actually engaged in coming alongside another person who thinks there's just no reason left to live. That's what the ministry of reconciliation at one level is all about. Yes, absolutely. We want to be reaching people for Jesus. But part of how we reach people for Jesus is that we walk with them in their sadness. We walk with them in their grief. We walk with them in their loneliness. So that, guess what? They're not lonely anymore. So I want to encourage people today as the connecting point to just go be the minister for loneliness in the culture. Go be the minister for suicide prevention in the culture today. It's genuinely, you know, from the very beginning, we know it's genuinely not good for us to be alone. We were designed to be in relationship. We were certainly designed to be in a relationship with God, and that is available through Jesus Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit. And ultimately, you know, that's the good news of the gospel we want to be sharing with people. But we got to start by simply walking into the loneliness in which they're living. People need some flesh on the gospel, and you and I are the ministers that Christ sends in his name and by his Spirit and with his authority to go and do just that. So that would be some of my encouragement today. Again, let's not wait for the government to come up with a solution to the challenges or the problems that we're facing today. Okay, so I got like a half a dozen other things we could talk about in the walk off today, but I think let's walk off with this. Let's walk off with this. This weekend, let me encourage you to be praying ardently. Be seeking the Lord. I'm a little concerned that a lot of folks are just running at such a pace. We're so hurried. There's so much on our schedules. There's so much on our agenda. We don't spend very much time simply being still and acknowledging that God is God. And so let me encourage you to create some Sabbath time this weekend. I don't know if you can take a whole day. I have no idea. But if you can, that would certainly glorify God, which is frankly what we're in the world to do. Hey, I've enjoyed being with you this week on Connecting Faith. We've got a great week lined up next week already. You know, there's always headlines for us to reflect on, and there's always great conversations for us to have. So thanks for joining us here on Connecting Faith. Visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.